This is Audible.
Blackstone presents The Burning by Anna Todd. This book is read by Lauren Ezzo and Jamie Lincoln Smith. To anyone and everyone who's ever felt lost, let me help you find yourself. I just started walking and ended up at the sea. I'm looking at the coast from here. There's endless sand and the rough wind. I'm still looking at a desert. I wanted to have the sea, so I swallowed you up. But I'm even thirstier than before. Is what I know really the ocean? Or a blue desert? Kim Namjoon. If we're together, even the desert becomes the sea. Army. BTS.
Prologue. Kale. The sea of black clothing makes my eyes hurt. It's been a while since I've been around such a uniformed crowd. I was so used to the camouflage I wore daily for years that even though I'm out of the army, I still look for the camo out in the civilian world. Sometimes I miss not having to think about my choice of clothes every day. When I take one of my freshly dry-cleaned jackets off the hanger, I remembered my ACU jacket that had fabric so stiff from caked-in sand and dirt that it crinkled as we marched for hours in the Georgia heat. My hand reaches under my shirt to touch the dog tags hanging around my neck. For comfort? For punishment? I'm not one of those soldiers who wear them as a prideful decoration or to get free drinks at local bars. I wear them because the weight of the metal on my chest keeps my feet on the ground. I'll probably never take them off. This morning at the coffee shop, I noticed Karina's eyes scanning my neckline, and I knew she was looking to see if I had taken them off yet. The answer will always be no. "It's a little cold in here," my mom says as I drop the dog tag and bring my hands to my lap. "Do you want my jacket?" I ask her. She shakes her head. "They have to keep the body cool or it will start to smell," a familiar voice says. "Still a sick fuck, I see." I stand up and hug Sylvan. His body's a lot thinner than the last time I saw him. His jawline sticks out like the villain of an action film. "Never gonna change either," he hits my arm. My mom looks at him with disapproval. "You better quit that." She hits him a little harder than he hit me. "How many times have I heard that?" Sylvan hugs my mom, and she breaks into a smile. She always liked him the few times they met, despite the fact that he could be an offensive prick with a crass sense of humor. His beyond dark sense of humor kept us all laughing through the lowest times in our lives, though, so I always liked him too. "How are you, man?" I ask casually, even though I know he's probably hurting more than most of the people in the church right now, like I had been at the last one. He clears his throat and blinks his red eyes. A puff of air blows from his cheeks before he answers. "I'm good. I'm good. I'd rather be in Vegas playing slots with a porn star and her money," he laughs awkwardly. "Wouldn't we all?" I joke back with him, careful not to add weight to his mind. Sometimes it's better to stay on the surface where you can stay numb. "Come sit down with us. Or do you already have a seat?" I ask him. "It's not a fucking concert, Martin," he says and laughs, coming to sit down next to my mom. Even though it's masking deep sadness, Sylvan's twisted laughter is the only inkling of happiness in the whole church. The ceiling is practically dripping with grief, the kind of sad that just bleeds into you and never washes away. It shows on you. The weight of everything you're carrying just flows through your blood and sits right on top of your shoulders. Sylvan sighs and leans back onto the wooden pew heavily, trying to give it some of the weight inside of him. His dark eyes stare ahead, lost in some memory that refuses to go away, denying him any chance of peace. He's too young to look so old. He's aged drastically since we all called him Babyface in our best Southern accents. He's from Mississippi and had looked about 15 during our first deployment, but now he looks older than me. Babyface had grown up a lot since he'd had chunks of what looked like raw tuna thump against his face as they fell from the sky. It took my brain another explosion to digest the horror of realizing the plague of chunks falling were pieces of human flesh, not fish. I was standing so close that a finger with a wedding band on it landed against the toe of my combat boot. Johnson's face had changed when he turned to look at him and realized that his battle buddy Cox was no longer standing there. I saw something in his eyes, the smallest gleam burning out as he lifted his weapon from his waist and kept on moving. He never mentioned him again, and after that, he sat in silence as Cox's pregnant widow cried at his funeral. Come to think of it, this funeral feels eerily similar. I look around for a clock. Isn't it almost time to start? I want to get this over with before I actually have to think about what we're doing here. Funerals are all the same, at least in the military. Outside of it, I haven't been to one since I was a kid. Since I left for basic training, I've been to at least 10 funerals. That's 10 times that I've sat silently in a wooden pew and scanned the faces of soldiers staring ahead, the straight line of their lips well practiced. 10 funeral homes full of shuffling kids who don't understand life, let alone death, crawling at their parents' feet. 10 times that sobs broke out in the crowd. Luckily, only half of the deceased soldiers were married with families, so that meant only 5 sobbing wives whose lives were ripped apart and changed forever. I often wondered when the calls would stop coming. After how many years would we stop gathering like this? Would it continue until we were all old and gray? Would Sylvan come to my funeral, or would I go to his first? I always went, as did Johnson, whom I spot out of the corner of my eye. Stanson, too, who was holding his newborn son. He's still in the army, but even the few of us who are no longer active duty still come. I flew to Washington State a few months ago for a guy I barely knew, but Mendoza loved. There are more people today than usual. Then again, this dead soldier was liked more than most of us. I couldn't think about his name or say it in my head. I didn't want to do that to myself or to my mom, who I picked up in Riverdale and drove with me to Atlanta. She always liked him. Everyone did. "Who's that lady there?" My mom coughs, her finger pointed at a woman I don't recognize. "No clue, Ma," I whisper to her. Sylvan's haunted eyes are closed now. I look away from him. "I'm sure I know that woman," she insists. A man in a suit walks on stage. Must be time. I cut her off. "Ma, they're about to start." I try to scan the pews for Karina. She must be here by now. She said she was coming straight here from the coffee shop. Next to me, my mom coughs again. She's been doing that more and more lately. She's had this cough for about 2 years now, maybe more. Sometimes it goes away and she's rewarded for quitting smoking. Other times it's wet and she gripes about how she might as well light up a Marlboro. I've argued with her half my life, since I was 10, and I heard her doctor tell her she was going to lose a lung if she didn't quit. I look down at her as she rubs the tissue along her lips, coughing deeper. Her tired eyes close for a second before she goes back to staring blankly at the flower-covered stage. The casket is closed, of course. No one wants these children to see the barely recognizable body. Fuck. I have to stop. I've spent God knows how many hours with medical professionals tasked with fixing me, so you'd think I'd be better at keeping those thoughts out. It never works. The techniques they teach us. The darkness is still there, unmovable. Maybe I should tell the government to get a refund on my therapy. They paid for it, as they should. But did it work? Clearly not. Not for Sylvan, not for me, not for the body in the casket on stage. Countdown. They recommended when my mind got this way. Count down and think of something that brings you joy or peace. Feel your feet on the ground. Know you're safe now. they repeated. I think of her when I need peace. I have since I met her. It only lasts so long until reality sets in, and I want to punish myself for the fact that she's not in my life anymore. And I walk deeper into the darkness. I don't get the chance to finish my self-therapy session. We're going to begin if everyone can take their seats now. The funeral director's voice is soft and unaffected. He probably does this a few times a week. The room quiets, and the funeral begins. After the service, we stay sitting while some line up for a last goodbye. Sylvan catches my eye and points upward like he's trying to tell me something. As I look up, someone taps me on the shoulder. I'd be lying if I didn't admit that I briefly hope it's Karina, even though I'm sure it's not. And of course, it's not. It's Gloria, standing behind me in a black dress with white flowers stitched across the top. I think I've seen her in that dress at all 10 funerals. Today has been a wild fucking ride already, from meeting Karina at the coffee shop this morning, to seeing Sylvan again, to losing the bid on a hell of a deal on a fourplex apartment just outside Fort Benning. Now seeing Gloria, who always reminds me of her husband. I've been failing to come to terms with the situation with him. It's proven to be a lot harder than anything I've done in my entire life. Hey, Gloria. I get up from the pew and hug her. Gloria hugs me and pulls back, then hugs me again.
How are you? I've been worried about you. You never answer my calls anymore.
She makes a face.
Asshole,
she whispers, looking me straight in the eyes. I've been swamped with work, and you know I hate the phone. She rolls her dark eyes.
The kids miss you, okay? And they ask about you a lot.
The kids. Acid that rises from guilt burns my throat. I miss them too. I look at her feet where the littlest one usually clings. I'll call more. I'm a shitbag. I smile at her and she nods, letting me off the hook a little.
You're a total shitbag,
she agrees with a smile on her face.
Uncle Shitbag still needs to call them once in a while.
She looks up and down my face.
I didn't even recognize you at first because of this.
She touches her palms to the stubble on my jaw. Yeah, I'm a free man now and decided to start acting like one.
I'm glad. It's good to see you, even if it's here of all places. And you,
she looks at my mom, and without breaking her conversation with the woman she recognized from earlier, my mom hugs and kisses her on the cheek.
Karina looks great.
Gloria purses her lips and stares into my eyes.
She always does. But she looks...
I look away as she pauses.
She looks happy. That's what it is.
She smiles. Gloria always loved Karina. And I've heard through the grapevine that they still hang out. The gossip reached me, even though I'd moved far away from Post.
Happy?
She couldn't have seemed further from happy this morning, but maybe I would only get the cold, detached Karina now. It's not like I didn't deserve that. I quickly scanned the church for Karina's hair. It's brown again. That color that's right between chestnut and chocolate, she told me once. It was her go-to color when she felt like she had her shit together. Controlling and changing her hair color was one of her rituals. She had many little things she did to exercise control while disguising it as luck. Yeah, I'm glad she is, I tell her. I saw her this morning. She doesn't have to tell me that she already knows. It's easy to gather from how unaffected she is. Anyway, the kids with you? I changed the subject. She gives me another eye roll and shakes her head.
No. My mom's with them back at Benny. I figured they'd been to enough of these for a while.
Haven't we all?
That's for damn sure.
A woman approaches us and moves to hug Gloria. She seems to know her, and they start talking. My mom is still in deep conversation, so I look for Karina again. How is it possible that I haven't seen her yet? The church isn't that big. Then again, she's good at blending in, hiding in the midst of a crowd. It's one of her things. My mom's voice cuts through the hushed greetings and condolences being shared around me while I'm lost in my own head.
Mikhail, where is it your sister is wanting to go to college again?
She asks, confusion in her eyes, despite the hundreds of conversations we've had about it. MIT, I tell the woman talking to her, who I recognize as Lawson's mom. I know she's a better person than her son, but that's not exactly hard to accomplish. After spending the last few years with him in my platoon, 2 deployments to Afghanistan later, I know Lawson better than even his own mother does. War brings people closer than anything can, except death. They go hand in hand in my world.
That's it, MIT. She's the smartest in her whole class this year and last. 2 more years to wait, but they would be crazy not to accept her.
My mom's black hair is falling out of the clip thing she always wears. The curls I helped her put in her hair this morning were falling now. I reached down to push her hair back from her face. The memory of Karina laughing at me as I burned my fingertips on a hot curling iron fills my mind. I knew she had to be the most thoughtful, selfless person I would ever meet when she offered to help teach me how to curl my mom's hair when we noticed burns on her hands. Some mornings, mom's hands would shake so badly that she couldn't do it herself, but she was too stubborn to ask for help. I don't travel home as often as I should, but my mom loves to have me curl her hair when I do. She says it will make me a good father one day. Karina said the same, with a look in her eyes, like she could see the future. Turns out she couldn't, and neither can my mom, because she still hopes for grandchildren from me to pass on the family name. Not fucking happening. There's no chance I'd ever punish the world with another me. I sigh and grab my phone from my pocket, checking it out of habit while glancing around the room. It's emptier now, so Karina will be easier to find. Eventually, I'll either know for sure that she's not here, or she'll appear from whatever corner of the room she's hiding in. That's if she didn't slip out, and knowing her, there's a high likelihood.
I'm right here, Dory.
Karina's soft voice sends both shock and relief throughout my body.
There you are. Everyone keeps talking about you, and here you are,
Ma says. Karina's brows draw together and she shakes her head.
Gossip as always.
Her lips curl into a smile, and she puts her arm around my mom's shoulders and squeezes. Karina's fingers go to Ma's hair, and she unfastens the clip. Her delicate hands twist her hair, then clip it back exactly how she likes it, and hell of a lot better than I can do. Man, they've come a long way since the beginning. It drives me fucking crazy with guilt that because of everything that happened, my mom doesn't have Karina in her life anymore. Unlike Gloria, who could drive to see Karina 10 minutes away, my mom will never even sit behind a wheel again. Not safely, at least. The laundry list of mistakes I've made over the last several years just keeps growing. Even though now we are living separate lives, I've done too many unforgivable things to her.
Do you want to go outside?
She asks Ma.
It's getting a little stuffy in here.
The green of her eyes catches on the stained glass church window. My mom follows Karina, and they both look back at me, standing still.
Well?
They say in unison. I'll go with you. I look at Karina. She stares back at me, her lips parting slightly, but she doesn't say anything. As we turn, my phone vibrates in my hand. I go to answer and catch Karina's eyes. She's staring daggers at my phone, one of her worst enemies. She expects me to answer it like I always do, so I ignore the call and keep her eyes on mine. She licks her lips and her eyes give away that she's surprised and that she sees this as a win. It was just one of my contractors anyway. Shall we? I ask her, digging in my position of at least trying to stay on her game board. She nods and leads us out of the church as the bells from its tower ring through the air. Chapter 1. 2 years earlier. Kale. My truck roared down the small street. I continued to hit my hands against the steering wheel as I drove far enough down the dark road to be out of her eyesight. I slowed to a stop on the gravel pullout a few blocks away and stumbled out of my truck. The ground was soaked with unforgiving rain, and as I looked into the darkness, I couldn't see more than 10 feet in front of me. It had only been a few minutes since I left Karina at her house, but the guilt weighed enough to feel like 30 years. Reaching for my phone, I called Austin first. My hands were shaking intolerably, and the rain was soaking my phone as I waited for him to pick up.
"Hey man, what's up?"
he asked in a casual tone. The nonchalant sound of his voice immediately triggered my anger. Even if I knew both of us did the right thing, I needed someone to be pissed at, and I could hear women's voices and music in the background of wherever the fuck he was. "Your sister found out," I flatly told him. Silence.
"Found out what?"
he asked. I know he wasn't that damn clueless. He was in shock, not that ignorant. "Where are you?" I was beyond impatient. He paused, took a deep breath in before responding.
"I'm at Mendoza's. What do you mean by my sister found out? Tell me it's not what I think it is."
"It's exactly what you think it is. I'm on the side of the road and I didn't call you for a heads up, Fisher. I called you to tell you that your sister is devastated. Could really use you right now."
"Did you tell her? I thought we were—"
Before I could help it, my fist slammed against the hood of my truck.
"It doesn't fucking matter who told her. What are you going to do about her right now?" "I don't even have a car. What can I do?"
"Are you drunk?"
"No."
He was lying.
"Yeah, I mean, I'm not sober. But it's not like I knew this was going to happen and got plastered so you had to deal with her. Maybe call Elodie. She should be home."
I ended the call before he offered another not thought out solution. The rain took a short break, long enough for me to consider driving back to her house to beg for Karina's forgiveness, to explain why I did what I did. The weight of the world pushed against my shoulders as I imagined her at home, alone, sitting in the dark kitchen feeling completely betrayed. I made the choice when I met her to try my best to take care of her, to make her life better, easier. But all I've done is fuck it up. I still stood by helping her brother get into the army before he could tank his life in a serious way. That's what this was. The sacrifice was temporarily hurting Karina, but in the big picture of her life, her brother being alive and breathing would matter more to her than the feeling she thought she had for me. A year from now, she would be proud of him instead of mourning him. After a month or two, she would barely think of me. She deserved to have that, and I didn't deserve to have her. So this was the way things would be. She will never leave my mind. But isn't love supposed to be about sacrificing? I didn't know. I had never loved anyone before. But it felt right. It felt wrong, but so right. I hoped to God Elodie was home and could comfort her. I thought about calling her, but I didn't want to admit what I had done. I knew Elodie lately had become attached to Karina's brother, and she would be pissed at me too, so I took the easy way out, climbed into my truck, and drove to Mendoza's. The solution wouldn't be there, but I knew a bottle of tequila would. Mendoza's house was lit up with every single light on. All the other houses on the street were dark and quiet. I parked in the driveway, right behind his van, and took a breath before getting out. Soon, I wouldn't be able to come here when shit went wrong. Once I was out, I would probably only see him at funerals or weddings or maybe never again. That's how it was in a soldier's life. You had unbreakable bonds, but when people got out, they usually moved back to where they came from and hardly ever looked back. Well, they looked back all the time, but physically never came back. I heard his voice before I saw him.
"Your truck keeps getting louder. I can hear it a damn mile away."
He greeted me with a soft smack to my shoulder.
"Yay, you're here,"
Gloria hugged me.
"What the fuck? You're soaked."
I tried to force a smile. Suddenly I wondered why the hell I was there. I didn't deserve the comfort of friends right now, when I knew Karina had no one. Carefully moving out of Gloria's arms, I tried to think of an excuse to leave, even though I had just arrived. Fisher's voice rang through the living room.
Yo,
he slurred. He was lazily sitting there, his arms stretched across the back of the white sofa. His eyes were barely open. How drunk are you? I questioned, moving closer. He laughed a little, tilting his head. He looked so much like Karina that it made me want to throw up.
Nah, I didn't drink.
He nodded toward Mendoza and Gloria, who were being grossly affectionate in front of us. Mendoza kissed Gloria's forehead.
He hasn't had a drink since he got here, but he's on some shit, that's for sure.
Gloria rolled her eyes and shot Fisher a look of disapproval. Fisher smiled and stretched his neck. He was definitely high out of his mind.
What are you on?
I pushed his shoulder, and he moved like jello.
Some soldiers dropped him off here like that, but I don't know them. I think he bought pills from them.
Again? I groaned. This motherfucker was really driving me crazy. I kneeled in front of him, and I saw Gloria and Mendoza leaving the room in the reflection of the window behind Fisher. There was a plastic baggie sticking out of the pocket of his sweats. I grabbed it, and he tried to stop me, but his reflexes were too slow from the drugs. Long, white rectangle pills and traces of white powder from them danced as I shook the bag in front of his face.
You won't be able to do this shit soon. They're going to piss test you regularly, and they will kick you out or lock you up if you don't pass.
I know. I just wanted one last night to celebrate, he groaned.
There was a sadness in his voice that almost made me feel for him. Almost. Your sister is completely destroyed right now, and you're here high as a kite, not having to feel shit. He closed his eyes.
You're here too.
Not with her.
She wouldn't let me stay, I defended myself. This irresponsible asshole gets to numb himself with drugs, and I have to just deal with it. And so does she. It was unfair and infuriating. Times like this, I wish I could show Karina why I helped her brother enlist, why his life was in danger, and why all of this was for her, whether she could see it yet or not.
You and I both are the last people she would want around her right now.
His voice was fading, his eyes bloodshot slits.
Maybe ever. And look, I know I'm a fuck up, but tonight just leave me alone with my mistakes, please, bro.
His desperation bled through his intoxication. I didn't say another word as Fisher's head slopped to the side. I just sat and stared at him, hoping I was doing the right thing. I watched the rain through the window as he slept or passed out, and Gloria and Mendoza never came back in. Chapter 2. Whose food is this? I tossed the dirty bowl into the overflowing sink. No one answered, and I didn't even know if anyone was home except me. Gunk-crusted dishes stacked in a chaotic pile filled my usually clean sink. There were beer bottles, half-empty and fully empty on the counter, wadded-up potato chip bags, and crunchy pieces of instant ramen noodles in their foil wrappings with flavor packets torn on the corner and dotted with chicken-flavored crumbles of seasoning. For a couple of weeks now, things had gone downhill. I had never allowed my place to look this disastrous, but I couldn't find it in me to give a shit lately. I used my teeth to tear open another packet and pushed a pile of empty takeout containers out of my way. I was fully aware that the trash can was merely 3 feet away, but it didn't matter. Not much mattered these days. I filled a bowl with water and pushed the noodles down enough to be covered before lazily putting my dinner into the microwave. I grew up eating these cheap ramen packets, 10 cents a piece. Most of the time, I didn't bother to cook them and just dumped the uncooked noodles into a Ziploc, poured the seasoning in, and took it to school. I spent more time making my sister's lunch when she got tired of being in the free lunch line. whatever I could do for her, because she was the brains of the family and needed the fuel more than me. Our mom's work schedule of two jobs didn't allow the luxury of some families. Time-consuming lunch preparation, perfect packages strategically, including every section of the food table, handwritten notes wishing us a good day, expensive sodas and name-brand chips. We didn't have any of that. But we had a mother who woke up before the sun and barely got a meal herself before her night job. I used to be bitter about it, and wish I had what the privileged kids I saw on TV or met during football game parties at the rich white schools had. Being what was considered talented at football gave me opportunities to mingle with kids who lived in wealthy Atlanta suburbs. I got invited to big houses with pools in the yard, and once, a kid gave me a brand new pair of Jordans just because he already had a similar pair. It would have been easy to feel like he was looking down on me, but I didn't really care, since I knew I could sell the shoes and buy my sister a new school uniform and take her to the movies with the money. New cars and fancy new Nikes, but none of them seemed to know what sacrifice was. Not one of them knew what it meant to work for what they had, and it made me appreciate my mom more. Even though she couldn't go to my games often because of her work, I knew that the reason I could play was because of her. Karina melted into my thoughts. One of the things I respected about her the most was how hard she worked to have what she wanted. She could easily ask her dad for help, but she never did. If something was broken, she would fix it. She was proud that everything she had was from her own two hands, literally. It made me feel connected to her because I valued working for what you have more than most people my age. The familiar smell of the ramen made me want to call my mom or my sister, but I knew I wasn't in the headspace right now, and they had more important shit going on in their lives than listening to me sulk on the phone and lie that my life was going great. I heard the sound of the front door shut as I inhaled a mouthful of noodles. I knew every sound of this place, and most places.
"Yo, you home?"
Fisher's voice rang through the duplex, bouncing from one wall to the other. He walked into the kitchen before I bothered to answer him. His face was blotchy, and his light hair a mess. Blue circles swollen under his normally bright eyes. "You look like you feel like shit," I told him. He nodded.
"Because I do."
"Good." Fisher lifted his t-shirt up and wiped his face with the bottom of it.
"I am so out of shape. Basic is going to kill me."
He plopped his head down on the counter. He was leaving in about 2 months and had started trying to get into shape about a week ago. "Yeah, and I'm sure the drugs help," I reminded him. He shook his head.
"You'd be surprised."
His grin was sarcastic and charming, even if we were joking about something heavy. "Have you talked to your sister yet?" he groaned.
"You ask me that every day."
"Have you?" I poked at his sweat-covered arm with my spoon. "Huh?" He rolled his head, whining.
"This is like having two annoying siblings annoy you at the same time."
"Good. You completely ghosted her since she found out about you enlisting." I was envious that she bothered him. She hadn't texted or called me once since that night. I kept checking her social media, and for the first week, it was great, but she eventually blocked me. I wondered if I had accidentally clicked something that gave away my stalking, or if she just didn't want to risk coming across me. "So have you or not?" He shook his head.
"Every day that goes by makes it harder. I don't want to face her right now."
"Have you ever thought about how she must feel?" I set my bowl down on the pile of dirty dishes as Fisher leaned up to face me. "It's for the best. You know that. If you explained to her why you did it, I think she would be more understanding. She wants the best for you, truly. She's probably so hurt now that it's been so long and you've avoided her."
"Why does it matter to you how she feels? You hurt her too. So don't give me that shit about thinking about how she feels when she's really probably more heartbroken by you than me."
A small hole opened up in my chest as he spoke. I knew he was wrong, but the idea of hurting her and betraying her trust had been feasting on my corpse for the last 2 weeks.
This isn't a competition of who was worse. We both fucked up. But you're her brother, her twin brother. I'm just a guy she halfway dated and hates now. He stood all the way up. Bullshit. You know you're not just a guy to her. We should have told her, and you're right. I'll be the one who has to face her and deal with her pain, and you'll be able to run off to Atlanta soon. I'll have to see the disappointment in her face, and you'll never see her face again. I reached for his shirt and balled my fist around the fabric. His green eyes went wide, and he raised his hands up in the air. Sorry, fuck sorry, Martin. I just feel like shit about it, and I'm pushing it on to you. I'll go to her house tomorrow. I don't know how much longer I can avoid her anyway. It's killing me day by day. He sighed and I let go of him. I don't think just showing up at her place without a warning is a good idea. If I call her, she might be working or not answer. She's texted me too many times for me to say sorry over the phone. I need to just face the music. His voice was shaking, and I knew even though his words sounded like he barely cared, he absolutely did and hated disappointing her. We had that in common. As selfish as it was, I felt like I knew Karina more than he did, which I knew wasn't true, but it made something inside of me feel satisfied or fulfilled, like the time I spent with her wasn't a dream or a waste of time. I would rather have felt that feeling at least once in my pathetic life than never at all, since people like me didn't get a fairy tale ending. I would take what I could get and leave it at that. I was already pushing my luck by having someone like Karina give me the time of day. And now, the time had run out, and I needed to get over her. Having her brother around me constantly didn't help me forget her. But maybe that's why I decided to spend my time helping him make his life better. I couldn't do that for her. So maybe doing it for him would help me repent for some of my sins. I needed to work on controlling my temper, and I knew my anger wasn't directed toward Fisher, just like his anger wasn't directed toward me. We both hated ourselves. That was the thing we had the most in common.
Chapter 3. Karina. Ding dong. The bell on the door of the spa rang, and I sprang up from the rolling chair I was lazily circling in. We hadn't had a customer in almost an hour, and not one of us had anyone on the books, so I was tending to the spa alone. I had dusted and vacuumed and filled up the oils in everyone's rooms. There was literally nothing else to do except scroll on my phone, and I was purposely trying to avoid that. I went through my typical pattern of typing Kale's name in, and as usual, there was nothing new. He had completely disappeared from my life. No apology, no trying to make excuses, nothing. I blocked and unblocked him twice before tossing my phone onto the desk. The door opened forcefully, and I had a potential customer to relieve my boredom. The man walking up to the counter had a sharp, square jaw like a pit bull and an Alabama state cap covering dark hair and hooded dark eyes. He was tall, ungodly so. "Hi, how can I help you?" I asked him, looking up at the clock on the wall and out the glass door behind him. It was dark, and that gave me chills. I hated being in the spa alone lately. I couldn't tell why, but I'd had this anxious, dreadful as hell feeling in the pit of my stomach for the last couple of weeks and just couldn't shake it. All I could think about was my brother going to basic training and being screamed at by drill sergeants. I couldn't stop imagining him with his hair buzzed off, in ACUs doing push-ups and obstacle courses in the scorching sun. Visions of him dodging IEDs and gunshots overseas consumed me, making my brain even more chaotic. By the time the man spoke, I had mentally left the lobby and was on a different planet. I was becoming so detached from my daily life that I wasn't sure if I was in the right headspace to be giving treatments to clients.
"Do you have any openings right now?"
he asked in a husky voice. My stomach dropped for the third time. I thought about telling him no, that I was booked for the rest of the night, but I really needed the money and my electricity was due the next week. And he most likely wouldn't try to murder me. He didn't know I was alone here, and that was good. I wished I didn't have to think that way. And even though I knew that I was more paranoid than most people, I also knew as a woman there were dangers around me all the time. Yeah. What sort of treatment are you wanting? I asked him, pointing up at the menu on the wall. The laminated posters were all curled up at the corners, and some of the prices were barely legible because of Molly's scribbly handwriting that had been fading since the spa opened. Every once in a while, I tried to use a Sharpie to trace over the faded sign, since Molly couldn't care less about it. She rolled her eyes every time I told her I would gladly make a new one, since it seemed to only bother me.
Like, an hour? I need a massage bad. My back is all fucked up right here.
He rubbed his hand on the top of his hip, twisting his body slowly. I can do an hour treatment. This is your first time here, yeah? I recognized every regular client, mine and everyone else's. He nodded, and I slid the clipboard with the new client sheets over to him. His fingernails were dirty, and his hands were so dry that his knuckles were cracked and had white rings around them. His face looked younger than his hands, but even looking straight into his almost black eyes, I couldn't guess how old he was. I could tell he worked hard and either was from Alabama or just liked the team. As he filled out the paperwork, I slid my phone from my pocket and discreetly checked it. A notification popped up right as I went to unlock the screen. It was from Instagram. I had 2 new followers and 3 likes on my latest post, which was a picture of a dandelion peeking up from blades of grass. 2 followers, huh? I might as well be an influencer with my 300 followers and 20 likes on some of my posts. My fingernails on a chair got hundreds of likes, though, so it clearly didn't take much to impress the people of the internet.
Here you go,
the man said, interrupting my daydream of being paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to post aesthetically pleasing photos on an app. Thanks. I looked for his name. Thomas. When you're ready, I'm all set. He nodded, and I led him back to my room. When we stepped inside the small space, he felt even bigger to me. So big that I had to look up at him when I spoke. I turned the music on and circled around the table to light another candle on the shelf. Besides your lower back, do you have any problem areas for me to focus on?
My head,
he said, and I waited to see if he was joking or not. He smiled a little and looked way less murderous when his cheeks dimpled. They don't pay me enough for that, so anything else? I smiled back at him and he shook his head. He wasn't so scary after all. And for pressure, do you want more Swedish, Thai style, light, medium, deep tissue? He looked confused.
Don't know the difference, but I guess medium? I've never gotten a massage before.
I groaned internally. I would either turn him into a regular or ruin his first experience. I hated the pressure. Self-inflicted, yes, but it still made me anxious. Why did I always have to be like this? It was exhausting. Okay. I forced a small smile. I'll give you a few minutes to undress to your comfort level and place your personal items in the basket. Go ahead and lie face down under the sheet and blanket when you're done, and I'll be back in about 2 minutes or so. Take your time. I walked out of the room and tied the curtain closed. I found myself on my phone again, this time rereading my last one-way conversation with Austin. 3 "Where are you?" messages and 1 "If anyone should be pissed and not answering, it's me," later, and still nothing. My twin brother and I had been through our share of fights, and there had been times that we didn't speak for weeks, but this was different. He'd done something that he knew would put a huge crack in our relationship and didn't seem to give a single fuck about it. Unanswered calls, even more unanswered texts. He completely ghosted me. His audacity was at an all-time high. He was a fucking liar now. No longer just a boy who fibbed sometimes to get what he wanted from our parents or from girls. He was a man now, One who fucking lied to me and joined the army with the help of Kale, whom I should have known better than to trust in the first place. But of course I was charmed by him, just like he'd planned, and I allowed myself to be used in the game he was playing with my father. A game more involved and way more intricate than I could even think about right now. I scrolled the conversation all the way up to when Austin was on his way here from his short-lived stint in North Carolina with our creepy uncle. Everything had changed so much since then. It felt like a completely different reality.
Ma'am?
The voice scared me enough to jump from right where I was standing in the hallway back to reality. Shit, I whispered to myself. How long was I out in the hallway? I had no idea. Coming, I peeped, instead of just playing it off like he had been waiting the appropriate amount of time. Pulling back the curtain, I rushed over to the table to attend to my neglected new client, who for sure was never coming back. Not even to murder me, let alone to get another treatment. How is the headrest? Are you comfortable? He nodded, and I pulled the sheet up to cover his entire back to begin. As my hands slid across his shoulder blades, my mind wandered out of the room, down the hall, and out the front door to the same place it always went lately. Chapter 4. I got home just after 10. Thomas, my new client, was the last of the day. He rebooked with me for 2 weeks out, and I thanked my lucky stars that he didn't leave unhappy. The hour went so fast, while my mind ran through an entire lifetime. Yet when I got home, time dripped as slow as room temperature honey. Elodie was asleep on the couch when I got there, so I turned the TV off, sat down on the chair, and stared into the darkness of my living room. I used to be so afraid of the dark, and sometimes still ran and jumped over the side of my bed to avoid anything that could possibly be hiding under there. I wasn't as afraid of the ghosts anymore, or the man who hid under the bed in the little girl's room in that urban legend movie that scared the hell out of me as a teenager, but that eerie feeling still hadn't fully disappeared. I spent my life with ghosts. Alive and not. Elodie lay there fast asleep. I was relieved as I'd tried to avoid conversation with her about all my drama these last few weeks. But I wondered how things were with her husband, Philip, and what fruit her baby was the size of this week. I'd been working and sleeping and not doing much else. Of course, I knew that I tried to detach from Elodie purposely. My pride was stronger than my curiosity. So I made plans to go on my own to my favorite little craft store the last two Saturdays, and had then spent both Friday nights talking myself out of going the next morning. The clock on the wall chimed. It was 10, and I was both tired and wired. My body was exhausted, but my mind wouldn't stop moving. I sat back in the recliner as my head pounded. The house felt empty, even with Elodie on the couch. Maybe it was me who felt empty. I'd had a lot of realizations lately, that being one of them. And also, that I didn't have many friends, and truthfully, never had. My closest one was pregnant and spending more and more time with her army wife friends, which I understood, but it just helped exacerbate the feeling of loneliness that was already consuming me. I didn't have family at that moment. It had been weeks since I had seen or spoken to my father. The recent rupture in our relationship was far from repaired. Yeah, my brother and I were twins, so we would be bonded for life, but he was nowhere to be found, as per usual when he fucked up. Time was another thing. 3 months ago, my life felt completely different. Austin was in North Carolina. My dad and I had a functional, if stale, relationship. Kale was a stranger to me. And that was easier. Simpler. It seemed impossible that I had known Kale for such a short amount of time, and yet he'd managed to fuck up so much of my life. Even as I sat in my dark, lonely living room, he came to mind. I just couldn't stop thinking about him, and it sure as hell wasn't doing me any good. I barely knew him, and the him I knew was a fucking liar. Why couldn't I get that through my thick skull? I kept repeating the same thoughts, ruminating on the fact that my life had been turned upside down, but no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't think of a solution and stayed in the vicious cycle. It had only been 2 weeks since I found out that Kale had helped Austin secretly sign up for the army. Literally the worst possible scenario for me, and Kale knew that. He just didn't care. My knees started shaking, and I ran my fingers through my hair. The clock had barely moved, yet I had played through the entirety of our time together, from our first meeting to our last. The way the rain pounded against my skin that final day was never going to leave me, no matter how hard I tried to forget. Ironically, I could imagine that over the next few months, I would ultimately spend more time remembering Kale than I did knowing him. How fucked up. I used to be good at forgetting things. Sometimes I even made myself forget that I had a mother who ran out on us and didn't look back. I was that good. But there was something about Kale that just wouldn't leave me alone, and I was torturing myself with it. I'd never counted days before, or stared at a clock just begging for it to move. I was becoming obsessed with time. I could feel it. I worried about becoming fixated, trying not to be as obsessive as my mother, but somehow that only made it worse. I just ended up fixating on trying not to fixate and inevitably wound up back at the kitchen table, sitting and staring at the clock again, wondering if time would ever speed up. I hadn't had an appetite and had been living off a few bites of toast that Elodie forced me to eat earlier today, and a couple bites of Molly's noodles. Molly had watched in disapproval as I sat in the break room, slowly chewing while staring at the wall. I told her I had eaten before my shift, but she always knew when I was lying. I just couldn't stand how disappointed and pissed off I was at myself. I felt like a total fucking idiot around everyone. Elodie especially, but also Molly. Even with my clients who knew nothing of the situation, my mind convinced me that they did and that they knew how gullible and just completely stupid I had been for falling for Kale's lies and bullshit. I hated myself even more for missing him, for spending hours every single day thinking about what I would say to him if I ever saw his lying face again. I loathed that at night I missed the warmth of his body and often woke up with tear-stained cheeks and swollen eyes. I wanted to get to the next phase of heartbreak, the one that everyone on Instagram claimed would compel me to go out with my friends and drink wine and laugh until we cried. Since I wasn't much of a crier and I didn't have any friends, really, all of that seemed unlikely. If I could just get to a point where I didn't look at his Facebook or didn't think about the way his sweat tasted on his lips when he kissed me. I pushed myself up out of the chair and went to the kitchen. My stomach growled at the sight of the fridge. I couldn't remember when I ate last. I grabbed a bag of bread from the counter and sat at the table. It was so dry, but not really having an appetite, I didn't care so much. And at least Elodie wasn't here to overtoast it. What felt like an hour later, I blinked out of a memory of Kale on my front porch, speaking to me in poetry as we just stared at the stars and talked about them. It felt kind of good to remember those moments, because they were some of the few memories from my life that I was happy to revisit, even knowing the pain that would follow. I looked up at a crack in the ceiling, imagining it had turned into a huge lightning strike shape that spanned nearly the entire kitchen. I stared through my roof, imagining the sky. Didn't the universe have enough sympathy to have the crack come next month, when it might not be raining nonstop like it had been the last few days? Knowing my luck lately, I wouldn't be surprised if it caused a problem with my roof that I didn't have the money to fix. I picked at the skin around my fingernails. The polish was gone, and I had started going for the skin. I tried not to, and even did what my mom taught me when I got my first crush on a boy and started to care, which was to sit on my hands whenever I had the urge. I hardly did it, but the memory of her advice was there, at least. I remembered, too, the day she said that, our mom had smiled wide at something she had gotten in the mail. She had clenched the letter to her chest when she opened it, Austin and I watching from the stairs. She'd looked up at the sky, a light in her spirit shining brightly. It was because of the light in her that day, the way she was beaming, that Austin and I looked at each other instead of her. I think we were scared of the darkness that was surely to follow. The light never lasted long, and we knew that. Chapter 5. I was scared shitless when I first woke up with my cheek against the kitchen table. My neck hurt from the way I'd slept, hanging halfway off the table. As I cracked my neck and circled it around, my dreams came back to me. Austin and I at the edge of the stairs, my mom making lasagna with us as she danced around the kitchen to Alanis Morissette. And then another dream about a crying girl with blood as tears. It had to be a metaphor for something, but I didn't have the capacity to analyze it right now. At 4 in the morning, I had woken up with a plastic-wrapped loaf of bread next to my head and closed the twist tie on the bag before dragging myself to my bedroom and flopping straight onto my bed without taking off my work clothes. When I finally got out of bed, I took a long shower to make me feel somewhat human. Walking down the hall into the kitchen, I popped a coffee pod into my old Keurig and waited for my lifeblood to pour into the mug. Outside the window, the sun was still hiding, and the sky was still crying as I sipped my coffee and picked at the stale bread still on a plate from last night. Elodie appeared in the doorway of the kitchen. "I'll be back soon, just grabbing some things from the store," she told me, hugging the back of my shoulders. She smelled like fruit and linen. "You sleep well?" I asked, looking at her frail face. She was pink and glowing, but her eyes were puffy. She needed to rest. "Kier, I'm sorry if you heard us arguing last night," she said, standing in front of me, her blonde bob swaying a little. I looked into her big, blue, and bloodshot eyes, and she bit down on her lip. "Philippe's just... he's stressed because he's not here. So we're kind of fighting a lot. But he's fine. Everything's fine," she assured me, her hands fidgeting in front of her body. I absolutely didn't believe her for one second, but I wanted her to feel comfortable and talk to me when she decided she wanted to. "I didn't hear anything," I shrugged. "I slept at the kitchen table, though." I laughed a little to drown out the sound of the crying girl from my dream last night. Elodie smiled, relief filling her adorable face. "Okay, I'll be back in a little while. I have to work, too." She double-kissed my cheeks and rushed out the back door. "Bye," I yelled to her as the screen door snapped back after her exit. I hated knowing they were fighting, and I hoped like hell it would get worked out for her sake. But if it didn't, I would be here for her and the baby in every way I could. According to Elodie, she'd watched a YouTube video that told her the calmer she was during the pregnancy, and the calmer the environment her baby was born into, the more calm the baby would be. So I was going to do my best to help make that happen. I put a load of my laundry in the wash and went back into my bedroom. It looked so different with my mattress bare, so much bigger without the pillows across the top of my bed. I moved the junk on the top of my dresser around. I swiped my finger across the surface, through the gray dust, and scribbled a K and a heart, but caught myself and scribbled it out. I had always been an inveterate doodler, all the way back to my middle school agenda book. Dust collected so fast in my little house, I could never really keep up with it. That, or the succulent on my dresser. It was dead now. Jesus, I couldn't even keep a cactus alive. I sat down on my bed and pulled my phone from my pajama shorts pocket. I never got any calls, but I still checked my phone constantly. I wiped the screen off on my pajamas and set it on my dresser while I chose my clothes for the day. The humidity from the morning rain seeped in through the cracks around my windows, and my room was like a sauna. It was miserable. I was nearly soaked by the time I finished getting dressed. I turned on the air conditioner in the corner, then turned it right back off, knowing my bills were high enough as it was. I needed to get out of my room before I spent the morning unnecessarily redecorating. Dishes. I could wash dishes. I had to be at work in half an hour and was already dressed in my uniform anyway. I went with an all-black funereal pair of scrubs. I had time to kill, and I knew Elodie would do them if I didn't. And why should she have to be the one to scrape off the pan from the other night's failed attempt at a lasagna? I turned on the water as her name popped up on my phone screen on the counter. Do you want coffee? I'm almost back home. I looked at the empty mug and replied. The more caffeine I could have, the better the day would be. Around noon, I'd get jittery, but that was just part of my routine these days. I thought about inviting Elodie to spend uninterrupted time with me tonight, after we got off work. That would be my chance to confess everything that had happened, everything I'd been hiding from her. I could make a reservation at the only restaurant in town that actually took reservations. I knew she loved their steak. It would be good for us to hang out outside the house for once. It would also be good for her to know that I was actively trying to spend time with her, and not just occupy the same space, sitting on the couch while we both tried to stay awake with our phones in our hands. So far, I was able to get away with telling her that I ended things with Kale because he's being discharged soon, and I didn't want to get wrapped up into that. She knew my stance on being with a soldier, so I thought I had convinced her. But the more times she asked, I saw the doubt grow in her eyes when I told her half-truths. Elodie was great at not prying, and she knew me well enough to know that pushing me to talk about what I wasn't ready to discuss wouldn't help our friendship in the long run. Maya Angelou taught Oprah, who taught me, that when people show you who they are, you should believe them the first time. People are often much less complicated than they want us to believe. They seem predictable, but when they show their true colors, that's who they really are. I tried to give the Army wives the benefit of the doubt that their budding friendship with Elodie was honest and genuine, despite the prejudgment engraved into my brain. I hadn't really met them, but I knew how cliques of young Army wives could be. They could be sugar or salt. I was suspicious that this group of women wasn't the kindest to Elodie before making her feel like an outcast at first, and then suddenly she was a part of their clique. I remembered the way my mom was treated like an outcast, and how that rejection made her rebel against her idea of the typical way an officer's wife was supposed to behave. The way my dad wanted her to be, as the homemaker and bearer of his last name. My mom was never one to follow the crowd. But the pressure cooked her until she exploded. Even Estelle, my dad's borderline Stepford wife, was at times the target of childish gossip, despite my dad being high up on the totem pole here at Fort Benning. They lived in the biggest model of house the post offered, and my dad bought her the nicest purses tax-free from the PX. She went above and beyond for acceptance from the women, from their bake sales and group trips to Savannah when tax season came. Still, no matter what she did, some of the wives still gossiped. They would say my dad's crazy, trashy first wife took off and never came back. Some of the other wives had actually liked my mom, and they would whisper that Estelle was probably having an affair with our dad before my mom left. Austin got in a lot of arguments, sometimes even fights with kids our age over our mom and the mystery of her disappearance. Elodie and my mom were completely different people, and maybe times had changed. But given the rhetoric I had grown up hearing, it was hard to release my judgment. Elodie felt like such an easy target for mean girls, so that didn't help. Her kindness and grace came so effortlessly, and her sweet accent that always made everything sound much softer made her an outsider in a way. One of them also recently accused her of hitting on their husband, whom Elodie had only double cheek kissed out of innocent habit. They turned on her quickly and had even made a post on Facebook talking about her in detail. But for some reason, they didn't say her name. It seemed they had all moved on since Elodie was hanging out with them again. But poor Elodie, she was getting it from all sides. Philip was calling more often from Afghanistan, and their disagreements grew by the day, it seemed.